Sexton Blake and the Time Killer. Midnight. Midnight underground in London. It sounds romantic. There is a suggestion of sinister happenings in the time and place. And yet, curiously enough, it is merely a matter of phrasing. If one places it thus, midnight in the underground, the thing becomes commonplace. And yet, to Sexton Blake, the celebrated criminal investigator, not even the platform of the Piccadilly Circus tube station, with its crowd of homeward-bound theatre-goers, was devoid of interest. In spite of years of experience of the seamy side of life, in spite of his keen, analytic, and sometimes ruthlessly scientific mind, there was a deep strain of the romantic in the character of the celebrated detective. He walked leisurely up and down the platform, his shrewd grey eyes scanning the little crowd of people who were waiting for the last tube train. A suspicion of a smile lurked round his finely chiselled lips as he noticed Pinker's frantic efforts to extract a packet from an automatic machine. Tinker's smooth, boyish face was flushed with exercise. His opera hat was pushed back from his forehead. They had both been to a sparkling review at the Pavilion, and after an excellent supper at a discreet little Soho restaurant, the two were returning home to Baker Street. Tinker pushed the chocolate furtively into his mouth and glanced rather impatiently at the electric clock in the tube station.
"It's a confounded nuisance waiting for the train," he said. "As it's the last one, I'll bet it'll be packed."
"Well, we shall soon see, my lad," consoled Blake.
There came a long, hooting wail from the blackness of the tube tunnel. The people on the platform, some of them in evening dress, moved forward expectantly. The train at last. Tinker instinctively stood back as he visualized the long, roaring carriages. But no train appeared. Again the faint, hooting sound, as if some goblin of the underground was chuckling in unholy glee. Then Tinker gasped and stabbed a trembling forefinger in the direction of the tunnel.
"Look, Governor! Look!"
A woman screamed hysterically. Sexton Blake craned forward, and even his immobile face betrayed momentary wonder. Framed at the entrance of the tunnel was the weird figure of an enormous hound. A strange, phosphorescent glow seemed to emanate from the steaming shanks of the brute. It seemed to be running along noiselessly, with its great yellow tongue flaming, and its cruel teeth seeming to drip with froth.
"Great Scott, Governor! What is it?"
Tinker's voice was hoarse, and he clutched at Blake's sleeve. The crowd on the platform seemed frozen with fear at the sight of this amazing apparition. No one moved. Everyone stared as if hypnotized as the uncanny monster advanced. It did not seem to touch the ground, but floated through the air in horrible, nerve-wracking silence. Far away in the bowels of the tube came another long-drawn hoot. Silent as a shadow, the flaming phantom hound glided straight through the tube station and disappeared before the astonished stare of nearly 100 people. They stood there an instant like living statues. Then the spell was broken. A woman sobbed hysterically and covered up her face with trembling, bejeweled fingers. Blake's face was strained and set. His grey eyes grew steely, and his pupils seemed to narrow to a pinpoint. Tinker licked his dry lips.
Oh, sorry, Governor. Did you see it?
I saw it, Tinker, said Blake gravely. Immediately, there came a shrill babble of voices. Men argued and women chattered. The detective frowned thoughtfully. What was the meaning of this amazing phenomenon? A ghost in the underground. Impossible. And yet he had seen the hound, an unearthly creature of no known breed. Tinker watched him anxiously.
What do you think?
He broke off with a start, for suddenly, with a dull reverberating roar and a long hoot, the train roared into the station. The rush of that throbbing, pulsating, familiar thing seemed to have broken the strained, unnatural atmosphere, and as they pushed forward into the carriage and heard the clang, cling, clang go echoing down the carriages, and the sudden roar of the motor, Tinker was inclined to regard the apparition as an evil dream. They were silent on the journey homeward. At Baker Street, the two got out. It was a crisp evening in December, and the stars twinkled frostily bright in the indigo sky above their heads. Tinker took in great deep gulps of the fresh night air. There was a note of thankfulness in his voice as he said,
I'm glad to get out from that ghastly place underground.
Blake nodded. They turned into their famous chambers in Baker Street. A cheerful fire was blazing in Blake's consulting room, and Tinker was glad to divest himself of what he inelegantly termed his glad rags. Blake himself removed his cloak and opera hat, and with a sigh of relief, snuggled into his stained and tattered dressing gown.
Bed, Tinker, my lad. Don't worry about this hound business. You couldn't have a nightmare worse than the reality.
The famous detective filled up his blackened briar and curled himself comfortably in his favourite attitude before the glowing fire. Tinker glanced a little wistfully at the opposite chair, but he was too used to his beloved governor's moods to intrude. Very softly, he closed the door and wished him good night. For hours, Sexton Blake was wrapped in thought and tobacco smoke. It was nearly 3 when he knocked out the dead ashes from his pipe, but the problem of the phantom hound was solved an hour before.
File 2.
Which I says to the gent, don't you go casting no aspersions on my character. I'm an honest woman, I am, I says, and I don't hold with microbes a-crawling all over my house. Fresh air I believes in, I says. And if you want to see Mr. Sexton Blake in his insulting room, you can...
Mrs. Bardell, Sexton Blake's worthy and incomparable housekeeper, was indignant, very indignant. It was 9 o'clock next morning. Blake, in spite of his late hour of retirement the night before, looked fresh and seemed to have a hearty appetite as he punished the inevitable eggs and bacon. Tinker grinned. His round, boyish face was, even now, red with the brisk toweling after his morning tub.
Quite,
said Sexton Blake, waving a deprecatory hand. There were times when the garrulity of the good lady jarred upon him, and it gave Tinker a good deal of delight to watch the stifled groans of his governor when Mrs. Bardell grew more than usually loquacious. "Shall we begin at the beginning again, Mrs. Bardell?" he said patiently. "Last evening, I gather, when Tinker and I left for the pavilion, a gentleman called who claimed to be a professor. He wanted to see me urgently, but would leave no card or name and address. He mentioned something about microbes, something with which I can vouch you are entirely unfamiliar." Tinker grinned behind a large piece of buttered toast. Mrs. Bardell flushed at Blake's tribute to her spotless housekeeping.
"Which I says, Mr. Blake, he's a nasty-tempered ginger fella with a foreign accent. I sent him away, and he was waggling his beard like a man possessed. He was observed, utterly observed."
With difficulty, Blake repressed a smile.
"I'm sure it was absurd, Mrs. Bardell," he said gravely. "However, as he did not steal the doormat, I don't think we need worry about him."
"I ain't so sure, Mr. Blake. I don't think that there foreigner could be trusted even with the doormat. Begging your pardon for interrupting your breakfasts, but I thought you'd like to know."
"It was very kind of you, Mrs. Bardell."
Blake's voice was as courteous as if he was talking to a duchess, and the worthy landlady, as she withdrew, muttered audibly to the cat, which had crawled up from the nether regions of the house,
"Nicer man than that Mr. Blake I never wish to see. He may be a detective, but he's a gent, a perfect gent."
Judging by the contented purr of the cat, she was also in complete agreement.
"Well, Tinker, my lad, did you dream about the hound last night?"
Tinker smiled.
"No, Governor, but I got a nasty shock this morning when Pedro put his paws on my bed and woke me up. I thought it was that horrible hound for one dreadful moment."
Blake smiled whimsically.
"I wonder who our red-headed visitor was last night, Tinker."
He idly ripped open the pile of correspondence on his breakfast plate. His mail was always heavy, and this morning was no exception. After wading through about a dozen charity letters, invitations to suppers and dances, and the usual kind notes from the inevitable Mr. Isaac Macpherson, who was willing to lend him £5,000 on note of hand alone, Blake came across a letter which seemed to interest him. He read it through carefully, instinctively noticing the texture of the paper and ink.
"Anything doing, Governor?"
Tinker's voice was hopeful.
"We are to receive a visitor this morning, Tinker, and the identity of our excitable professor is solved."
Tinker's eyebrows arched into interrogation.
"Oh? Who is he?"
"Professor Rufus Llewellyn, the man who invented the new Z-tubes for overcoming atmospherics in wireless," said Blake gravely.
Tinker gasped.
"Great Scott, Governor! The man the papers all went crazy about a few months ago. They say he's half mad."
"That's the man, Tinker," said Blake. "One must forgive much to genius. Professor Rufus Llewellyn is one of the most amazing men alive. He's certainly one of the most distinguished scientists that has ever appeared upon this planet. He's brusque, excitable, I grant you, but a man who has done such a lot for the advancement of science can be forgiven trifles like that."
But what does he want to see you about?
Tinker's voice was interested. Blake handed over the letter, which was written on flimsy green paper, as if it had been hurriedly torn off from some wrapping round a package. Tinker looked at the small, cramped handwriting, and it was with difficulty he deciphered it. The letter ran, "Sir, I must see you. Your dote to the landlady was most offensive. Sir, I must see you. Be in tomorrow, I crave. It is important. You are a detective. I hope you are. Rufus Llewellyn."
"Well, I'm hanged."
Tinker's voice held a note of disgust.
"If that's a specimen of the letter writing of England's greatest scientist, I'll go back to school."
Blake pointed to a copy of the Daily Mail on the table, and Tinker stared at the heavily inked lines. "Phantom Hound in the Underground. Midnight Tube Mystery. What is it?"
"Blowed if I know how these newspaper guys do it," said Tinker,
as he read the account of the strange midnight occurrence of the night before. No explanation was offered of the mystery. The report simply concluded with the words, "What is this ghastly hound? Is it supernatural, or is it some strange trick of the imagination? Watch out for the werewolf of Piccadilly." Then followed exclusive interviews with about a dozen people who had been eyewitnesses of the occurrence. Blake groaned as the telephone receiver jarred suddenly. The voice of a smart young reporter on the Daily Mail twanged over the wires. Blake's voice was icily incisive. "Yes, I did see the hound," he said slowly.
"What's that? Any theories?"
"Yes, rather."
"Will I give them to you?"
"With pleasure." A delighted chuckle came from the other end of the wire.
"Do you think it's supernatural, Mr. Blake?"
Blake deliberately winked at Tinker.
No, it was the salmon for supper."
Very gently he replaced the receiver.
"One thing about newspaper men is that they're too quick. I don't give any theories until I've established at least a few facts. Pass me the newspaper cutting book, Tinker."
Tinker took out the latest volume from Blake's library of press cuttings. They were neatly indexed and cross-indexed. It was a task that Tinker loathed, but he did it conscientiously and well. Without it, much of Blake's efficiency would have been impaired, and it was with a grunt of approval that the famous detective noted that the book was practically up to date. He lit his battered pipe and leant thoughtfully over the volume of clippings. His long, slender, nervous fingers turned over the leaves rapidly, and then he gave a grunt of satisfaction.
"Found anything, Governor?"
Tinker's voice was gruff. Blake grunted. "Remember a few weeks ago, Tinker, a little dog was lost in the underground. Here's an account of it in the Daily Mail. It seemed that the poor little animal leapt onto the permanent way from its mistress's arms. In spite of frantic efforts on the part of the station officials, the poor little brute dashed like a mad thing into the tunnel. Its body has never been recovered. Whether it was electrocuted by touching the live rail, or whether it crawled out again, no one is able to say. It might have been crushed to death by an oncoming train. In any case, it's not been seen since." Tinker's eyes grew very round. He hesitated a little before inquiring,
Say, Governor, you don't seriously mean to think that this ghastly-looking hound is the ghost of that poor little dog? Why, it's utterly absurd. The little dog was a Pekingese. Why, that ghastly creature we saw last night was more like a wolfhound.
Blake smiled enigmatically.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Tinker, than are dreamed of in your philosophy.
File 3.
Look you, it's all right, Tinty, to goodness, my good woman. I will go and see Mr. Sexton Blake myself. I haven't seen him this long time since whatever.
Tinker started to his feet with a cry of amazement, while Blake hastily rose from his chair. A loud, not unpleasant voice, with an appalling Welsh accent, boomed from behind the door of the consulting room.
"Who on earth is that?"
gasped Tinker hoarsely. Blake chuckled as he heard a muffled remark about impudence in Mrs. Bardell's throaty voice.
"Show Professor Llewellyn in at once, my lad," he said.
Tinker opened the door and said civilly,
"Mr. Blake will see you, Professor."
A tall, raw-boned man, well over 6 feet in height, entered the room with a strange, shambling gait. His shoulders sloped like the neck of a bottle, while his long, lean legs, with their corrugated trousers, reminded one forcibly of hairpins with wavy centres. A flaming mass of orange-coloured hair clustered about his face, which was almost hidden by a tangled mass of red whiskers. Tinker had to check a tendency to grin outright as the extraordinary apparition entered the room, casting a glance of disdain at the disgusted Mrs. Bardell. Blake stepped forward courteously and bowed.
"My dear Professor Llewellyn, this is indeed a pleasure," he said.
"Indeed, yes. You got my letter, I suppose, Mr. Blake?"
Sexton Blake nodded and waved his strange visitor into an armchair. Tinker hung about in an undecided fashion by the door and almost trembled as the professor's beady eye transfixed him with a glance. Then he smiled, for the eyes of the professor were of a vivid blue and shone with kindliness and good humour.
"Bright boy, Mr. Blake, bright boy. Extraordinarily well-developed cerebrum, look you."
Tinker flushed slightly. There had been many curious visitors from time to time in Sexton Blake's world-famous consulting room, but seldom one quite like this, who referred in such an easy manner to his forehead development. Blake waited until his visitor chose to speak. He knew Rupert Llewellyn of old. He had met him once or twice at various scientific gatherings, and his respect for the red-headed Welshman's amazing genius was tempered by his knowledge of the professor's weaknesses.
"Look you here, Mr. Blake. You're a good fellow. I know you. I've seen you. I trust you. Some scoundrel has stolen something of the most inestimable value from my laboratory. I cannot tell you what it is. Mind you, it's not because I do not think you're an honest man. Whatever else you are that, whatever."
Quite.
Sexton Blake's face was as inscrutable as a sphinx. He knew that the appalling accent used by the professor was simply one of his mannerisms. Rufus Llewellyn was inordinately proud of his Welsh descent, and in his spare time wrote the most fiery speeches, calling upon Wales to to revolt against the accursed English. Nobody ever took him seriously as a Welsh patriot, but as scientist his name was revered and respected all over the world.
I suppose you criminologists must be as exact in your own way as we scientists. After all, criminology is a science, look you.
Yes, said Blake quietly. No, hardly an exact science. The professor produced an enormous black cigar, which, large as it was almost lost in his tangle of beard, so the tinker dreaded to see him set fire to his whiskers as he lit the fragrant weed with a match held in his acid-stained fingers.
Well, briefly it's this, Mr. Blake. Let us assume that you are not interested in the contents of the box which has been stolen from my laboratory. Whatever it contains, you may take it from me, mind you, that it is valuable. Here's a photograph of the box.
From his pocket, the professor produced a quarter-plate photograph of a wooden box, about a foot square, with handles of brass, and let into the top a plaque, also of brass.
Did you photograph this before it was stolen? Asked Blake swiftly.
The professor smiled.
Oh, dear. Oh, that was smart of you. Indeed, to goodness it was. No, I photographed the box after it had been stolen.
Tinker gasped.
Was the professor mad?
You see, continued Rufus Llewellyn, puffing violently at his cigar,
I had two boxes. I always keep my germ culture in boxes like these. So, to save time, I photographed a box identical to the stolen one and brought it along for you to see. I know nothing except that the box has disappeared. How or why, I don't know. I can only tell you that inside were millions of deadly germs.
Said Sexton Blake noncommittally.
What kind of germs were in this box?
Professor Llewellyn hesitated for a fraction of a second.
Oh, Mr. Blakecraft, I cannot tell you. I am bound by a promise not to tell. The germs are not entirely my own discovery. Half the credit belongs to a colleague of mine who is at present in South America, searching for a rare orchid.
Answer me one question, said Sexton Blake.
Would these germs, if released, cause a pestilence like plague, cholera, or consumption?
Oh, I will answer that at once, look you, replied the professor promptly.
Oh, they will not cause a pestilence, but it is extraordinarily important that they should be returned to me. If you can find that box, I shall be everlastingly grateful to you.
Sexton Blake tapped the photograph with the stem of his briar pipe.
I notice that on this plaque you have your name engraved. I presume the same thing applies to the stolen box of bacilli?
That is so, Mr. Blake.
How many people besides myself know about these germs?
Oh, myself and one other, Professor Mencken, who left for America 2 months ago.
Well, that is the situation, Mr. Blake. I must have the germs safe before Mencken arrives back. If not, there will be terrible trouble. I suspect no one. My laboratory is burglar-proof. Oh, you've plenty of time. Mencken will not return for 1 month.
He rose to his feet with a swift, ungainly gesture.
Oh, goodbye, Mr. Blake. I'm very glad, indeed to goodness, I am to have seen you. Come over and make all the investigations you can as soon as you can. I will help you to the best of my ability. Good morning, and a very good morning to you. And whatever you do, say nothing to anybody."
With a quick, jerky stride, the professor left the room without even the formality of shaking hands with Blake. Tinker grinned a cheerful good morning, and the extraordinary professor dug him playfully in the ribs with a lean forefinger, and then clattered down the stairs.
"Good heavens, Governor, I hate to say anything about your red-headed pal, but don't you think he's got bats in his belfry? A little bit balmy on the crumpet, eh?"
Sexton Blake smiled. "In spite of the inelegance of your diction, my boy, I think I gather your meaning. But if you imagine that Professor Rufus Llewellyn is not quite compos mentis, you're vastly mistaken. The question that now remains is whether I shall take up the case of the stolen germs."
File 4.
"I suppose, my dear Tinker, that it would be best to run over and see whether the professor is still keen on recovering his mysterious box of microbes," said Sexton Blake a little later in the day, after he had finished his correspondence. Tinker nodded.
"I'll bet the silly old ass has mislaid it somewhere. All professors are absent-minded, you know, Governor. He's probably in his lab all the time, hidden away behind a few test tubes."
Down traffic-laden Baker Street came the shrill, piping call of the newsboys. In the quaint jargon of the tribe, they called out loudly, "Extra special, amazing disappearance!" Tinker pricked up his ears.
"I say, Governor, looks like a sensational stunt," he said,
and he dashed downstairs to return a few minutes later, flourishing a copy of the Evening News, still warm and damp from the press. He pushed the newspaper before Blake's eyes and pointed to the extra bold splash headlines. Blake's usually inscrutable face betrayed a more than ordinary interest as he read the heavily leaded lines. "Amazing disappearance of Lord and Trade Union Leader. Mystery of Lord Lavendale and Mr. Tom Gunn. Is it a Bolshevik plot? A most astounding and inexplicable mystery has been reported to Scotland Yard. It transpires that Lord Lavendale, the well-known sporting peer, and Mr. Tom Gunn, the equally well-known trade union leader, lunched together at Pomano's on Monday last. The jovial leader of the National Union of Steelworkers was invited by Lord Lavendale, whose sympathy with labour is well known, to discuss matters of a general nature with him. The luncheon party was purely informal and broke up shortly after 2 p.m. From that moment, nothing has been heard of either Lord Lavendale or Mr. Tom Gunn. They have disappeared utterly. Lord Lavendale, who was to have attended the Stadium Club this evening to witness the Bencham Brisket fight, has not put in an appearance since his town residence, and inquiries at his club have elicited no information as to his whereabouts. Mr. Tom Gunn, MP, who was to introduce an important bill in the House tonight, is also missing. He is a bachelor MP and lives in Kensington. His house is kept for him by his sister, who is almost distracted at his non-appearance. Scotland Yard are making diligent inquiries into the affair, but no details are forthcoming."
"What do you make of that, Governor?"
said Tinker triumphantly. Sexton Blake pursed his lips thoughtfully.
"It's impossible to say, my lad. From this meagre and obviously hurriedly written report, one can glean little,
save that both the noble lord and the genial MP have disappeared. It is certainly remarkable, but I do not see any case for suspecting a sensational Bolshevik plot. If they had not both been well-known public men, their disappearance would have excited little comment. What's to prevent them going for a little holiday jaunt together, free for a while from the cares of office? I admit it's remarkable that they've not informed their relatives of their whereabouts, but perhaps they're tired of this interminable newspaper publicity.
When you don't think, Governor, that this is in our line?
Tinker's voice was disappointed. I cannot tell you, my boy. If Scotland Yard needs any help, I'm always ready to do everything in my power. For the moment, I must just ask with eyes. Wait and see, said Tinker with a grin. Sexton Blake nodded. There came a tap at the door, which Tinker rose to open. Mrs. Bardell entered.
There's a gentleman to see you urgently, Mr. Blake, she said. This is his card.
She handed over a slip of gilt-edged pasteboard. The detective scanned it swiftly.
Well, show him in, please, he said.
A moment later, a tall young man stood on the threshold. He had an olive face with dark, oily hair brushed smoothly back from a rather high and slanting forehead. His nose jutted out like a crag above firm, straight lips and a small, wax black moustache. The newcomer was obviously flurried, for he coughed nervously and fingered his tie in an impatient manner.
Mr. Sexton Blake?
He asked, with a faint hint of a foreign accent in his voice. Blake nodded.
What can I do for you?
He asked courteously.
You are the celebrated detective, is it not?
Returned the other.
Pray pardon my intrusion without an appointment, but the matter is of the most urgent nature. I am Alexis, King of Rosario.
The criminologist's eyebrows arched a little.
You will pardon me if I'm curious. I thought that Rosario was a republic.
The young man seated himself in the armchair.
That is the point, Mr. Blake. I am the rightful King of Rosario. It was, until the year 1879, a little separate kingdom. Then came a revolution, and a republic was established. I am the descendant of Alexis III of the royal line, and I am in peril of my life.
Sexton Blake nodded.
You will pardon me,
he said courteously, and signed to Tinker.
The gazetteer, please,
he said. The stranger started, and he lowered his voice.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Blake, but the business I have in hand is most urgent and confidential.
Oh, you may speak freely in front of my assistant, said Blake.
He is the soul of discretion.
Tinker handed the criminologist a leather-bound gazetteer. Blake's long, nervous fingers flicked over the leaves. His eyes narrowed.
It is as well to make sure of one's facts, he explained. Here we are. Rosario, a small island republic situated in the Mediterranean Sea, 30 miles from the mainland off the Italian Riviera. It is noted for its mild and temperate climate. Its quaint villages are relics of a medieval civilization. The chief industries are, in the winter, sardine fishing,
and in the summer, the tourist traffic. Formerly a tiny independent kingdom, it is now a republic under a federal government. The president, Guido Marinetti, is the principal hotel proprietor of the island. Meager, but nevertheless illuminating, said Sexton Blake. Perhaps you would tell me precisely what are the facts of your case.
Well, Mr. Blake, the Rosarians have grown tired of Marinetti. He is a clod, a dull, hopeless tradesman. Since the war, things have gone from bad to worse. There have been strikes, and there is much poverty in my island kingdom. The tourist industry has been practically nil. There is a strong feeling in favor of a revolution and the re-establishment of a monarchy. I have come to England to see certain financiers. I believe that with the aid of £250,000, I will set Rosario in her place again among the nations of Europe. True, we are only a small island, but we have a history, Mr. Blake. A history, if I may say so, as rich in heroism as this island of England.
Sexton Blake nodded slowly.
I confess that this is indeed news to me, he said. Why have you sought my aid?
Oh, listen, Mr. Blake. My life is in danger. Marinetti is an unscrupulous man. He does not wish to release his hand from the government. He is aware of the royalist plans to place me back upon the throne of Rosario. I was educated here in England. I am a democrat at heart, but I think that my country will be served better by a monarch than the present corrupt government.
Then you have been followed to London? Said Blake. The other nodded.
Twice my life has been attempted, he said. I carry a revolver always. The last attempt upon my life occurred last night. Returning from the theatre, I was set upon by a gang of roughs. At least they appeared roughs at the first glance, but one of them spoke in the Rosarian dialect, and I guessed that they were emissaries of Marinetti.
Sexton Blake nodded thoughtfully. He was keenly interested in the strange story of the man who called himself the King of Rosario.
What is required, he said, is not the service of a private detective, but the care and vigilance of Scotland Yard. I have so many cases on hand at the moment that I'm afraid I cannot undertake the business myself. I advise you, however, to return to your hotel. By the way, where are you staying?
The Hotel Olympic,
replied the visitor promptly.
Excellent, said Blake. Tompkins, the hotel detective of the Olympic, is known to me. It's purely a question of guarding you, and I think you could not leave it in more efficient hands.
You will excuse me, won't you? Said Sexton Blake.
Very courteously, he rose to his feet and held out a slim brown hand.
The young man seemed to be somewhat crestfallen.
I am sorry, Mr. Blake, but I am obliged to you for your advice. It is not a question, I see, of deduction, but only one of protection. I will take your advice and inform the police. I hope to negotiate the loan by next week. Then, viva la revolution!
He took up his hat, and his cheeks flushed with excitement. Tinker opened the door and bowed the visitor out.
"Most calls, Governor," he said presently.
"We're getting a rum lot of visitors this morning. Would you like a rat guy?"
Quick, snapped Sexton Blake. Shadow him, Tinker. I believe there will be interesting developments. Tinker seized his hat. His eyes sparkled with excitement. He stepped noiselessly down the steps of the house in Baker Street and followed the unsuspecting King of Rosario into the street.
File 5.
It was not very difficult for Tinker, after his years of experience in the underworld of London, to shadow the King to the Hotel Olympic in Piccadilly. As he swung through the plate glass doors of the hotel, about 2 minutes after the entrance of the King of Rosario, Tinker glanced swiftly at the indicator. The hall porter was busily engaged in telephoning, and he did not notice the youngster's well-dressed figure as it stepped into the waiting list. As he shot up soundlessly to the fourth floor of the hotel, Tinker wondered what was going to happen. Why had Blake ordered him to follow the self-styled king? He wondered if the man was staying incognito in the hotel. The lift deposited him on the fourth floor, and a perky page boy inquired his business. Tinker, wise to the ways of page boys, tipped him half a crown and murmured something about catching up his friend. He walked briskly down the thick-piled, carpeted corridor. He was just in time to see the figure of the king disappearing into a room at the end of the corridor, which overlooked the fire escape. Noiseless as a cat, Tinker stepped out onto the iron ladder. To his delight, he saw that it overlooked the window of the bedroom. He peered in. The man who had called himself the King of Rosario was sitting down before a mirror. Tinker noticed that he had taken off his coat. As he continued to watch, to his astonishment, he saw the man in the room carefully detach a beautiful, close-fitting wig. Tinker could hardly suppress a cry of astonishment, for the red head that was disclosed gave the man in the room an appearance that was vaguely familiar. Tinker noted that the other, with a few deft touches of grease paint, accentuated the sallowness of his complexion. He then carefully adjusted his sleek black wig, and, as if satisfied with his renewed disguise, put on his coat, took up a small leather attaché case, and left the room. Tinker waited until he heard the slam of the lift gates at the end of the passage. The coast was clear. Very cautiously, he raised the sash of the window. It was ticklish work. It was tantamount to housebreaking. Yet the boy felt instinctively that something was very wrong about the so-called King of Rosario. Tinker's deftness of touch served him in good stead as he noiselessly raised the sash and entered the bedroom of the king. It was quite plainly furnished. Two trunks, one of them locked, were placed neatly against the wall. On a desk was a sheaf of papers, and Tinker examined them carefully. There were two or three letters addressed to Michael Malone.
So His Majesty's real name is Mike, mused Tinker. Pretty good name for a king,
he grinned.
I wonder what the deuce made the governor suspect.
He broke off suddenly, for his keen eyes spotted a sheet of blue linen-faced paper stamped with a coronet.
Oh, my stars! It's from Lord Lavendale to Mr. Mike Malone, alias the King of Rosario.
It was very brief, and read simply,
"Dear Mr. Malone, I have pleasure in accepting your kind invitation. Mr. Gunn and myself would be delighted to join you at Pomana's for lunch today. Sincerely, Lavendale."
Tinker whistled. The date on the letter was December the 5th, the last time the sporting peer and the well-known trades union leader had been seen alive. Since then, they had utterly disappeared. What had they in common with the mysterious Michael Malone, King of Rosario? For some time the young detective remained lost in thought as he gripped the letter in his hand. It was obvious from Sexton Blake's peremptory command that the criminologist had already suspected that the sleek, olive young man was not all that he should have been. A cursory search around the room elicited very little, and Tinker debated the advisability of taking the letter along with him, or merely memorizing its contents. He resolved finally to trust to luck that the pseudo-king would not notice the disappearance of the document, and he folded it up carefully and slipped it into his pocket. He reclosed the window and noiselessly slipped the catch of the bedroom door and closed it gently behind him. He nonchalantly lit a cigarette, humming a gay little tune as he stepped along the soft pile carpet of the corridor in the direction of the elevator. Once outside the hotel, Tinker took a taxi straight to Baker Street. Sexton Blake was seated in his customary attitude in his luxurious armchair before the consulting room fire, his fingertips pressed lightly together, and an abstracted look in his keen grey eyes.
"I say, Governor, how on earth did you spot that the King was a fraud?"
Blake raised his eyebrows.
"Hello, Tinker. You're back soon. You found anything?"
"Sure."
With a little grin of triumph, the youngster handed over Lord Lavendale's letter. Blake frowned thoughtfully as he lit his battered briar. After reading the brief message, he held the notepaper up to the light and scrutinized keenly the watermark.
"Seems genuine enough, Tinker. Tell me, where did you find this?"
Tinker briefly explained all he had seen in the King's suite at the Olympic Hotel. Blake took long, reflective puffs on his pipe, and his fingers drummed nervously on the arms of his chair. "It was obvious, my dear Tinker, that our engaging visitor was an impostor. You know that I'm no mean master of the art of disguise, and I'm afraid that our visitor's makeup, while no doubt excellent for a passing glance, was not quite natural enough to deceive a trained observer. Wigs are difficult things to adjust, and I noticed a tuft of red hair on his left temple, emerging coyly from beneath his black wig. Then again, a carmine liner must be handled with dexterity and skill. The crow's feet around the eyes were far too heavy. It was a simple little piece of observation, and I acted at once on my suspicions, though why or wherefore a man should pretend to be a non-existent king of a tenth-rate island, I cannot for the life of me imagine.
Do you think he might be a spy or some secret service merchant, Governor?"
asked Tinker.
"Well, it's obvious he's a friend of Lord Lavendale's from this letter. I mean, look at the date. December the 5th. I'll hike along to Pomana's and find out whom they lunched with. Unless, of course, this Mike Malone is another person altogether, and the fake king pinched the letter from him."
Blake smiled inscrutably. I'm beginning to see a little more daylight, Tinker, he said, with a smile. That sound which startled you so in the tube last night, the problem is solved. You remember my talking to you about the little dog that disappeared in the tunnel the other day? A little association of ideas put me on the right trail. Oh, I must admit, this late edition of the Evening News has helped me considerably. He pointed to the theatrical column of the paper, and there, boldly outlined in black and white, was a picture of a spectral hound. Tinker gasped as he saw it.
Why, Governor, it's a blooming cinema film!
Blake laughed shortly. Yes, some advertising genius has certainly managed to hit the public right in the eye, as the saying is. This is an American super film to be shown at the West End tonight for the first time. The method of advertising was characteristically Yankee. Bold and effective, if a little blatant. Probably the publicity man read the account of the little dog's disappearance in the tube tunnel, and that suggested to his inventive brain a remarkable scheme to advertise the Phantom Hound. Anyway, I rang up a reporter on the Mail and suggested the theory to him, and it seems that the whole thing was a clever optical illusion run by the cinema as a stunt. There was a kind of cinema projector hidden above the signal cabin in the tube station, which directed the image of the hound onto the whitewashed walls of the tube tunnel. Midnight, the uncanniness of the apparition and the glamour of the underground did the rest. So there's one little problem solved, at least. Tinker glanced admiringly at Sexton Blake.
What a stunt, Governor! Cool. Fairly took me in, and you solved the old business without shifting from your armchair.
Blake smiled.
Oh, it was simple enough, Tinker. One simply needs to study the methods of the average journalist and publicity man to know that they get their ideas from the same source, popular and sensational articles in the newspapers. However, there is still the mystery of Professor Llewellyn's microbes, and on top of that, the affair of his pseudo-majesty. You'd better run along to Pomano's and get as much information as you can regarding the little luncheon party of the other morning.
Right you are, Governor. It's a mighty puzzling business to me altogether. Do you think...
Sexton Blake grinned.
I must have more data, my lad, he said. Leave this letter with me. Probably I shall be able to account for the King of Rosario's most intriguing visit.
The youngster adjusted his hat at its customary rakish tilt and left the famous consulting room. It was nearly 5 o'clock when he finally reached Pomano's. Luigi, the manager of the famous restaurant, knew Tinker well. Blake and he often used to dine at a discreet little table in the Palm Lounge. The little Italian rushed up to Tinker with his brown eyes full of concern.
There is nothing wrong, is there?
He said, shrugging his shoulders and extending the palms of his hands with a deprecatory gesture. Tinker smiled.
No, Luigi. But I should like a few words with you in your private office. Certainly. Come this way, Mr. Tinker.
The manager grabbed the young detective by the coat sleeve and swept him hurriedly into his private sanctum.
You know Lord Lavendale well, do you not, Luigi?
He inquired.
Oh, but certainly, sir. I am the most aggrieved that he disappeared in so very extraordinary fashion. Last Monday night he and the two friends lunched at the very table I reserved for you and Mr. Blake.
Tinker's eyes sparkled.
Oh, did you recognize his two companions?
he asked.
Oh, one, I know him by sight only. It is Mr. Tom Gund, the Trades Union MP. The other gentleman who was the host, I have never seen him here before.
What was he like? Demanded Tinker crisply.
Oh, a young man with the most charming smile, and the hair was what you call ginger.
Tinker frowned. A man with red hair. It was fairly obvious, therefore, that on Monday the mysterious person who claimed to be the King of Rosario had been the host of Lord Lavendale and the well-known Labour leader. He thanked Luigi courteously, and the olive-skinned little manager lowered his voice.
I pray you will forgive, Mr. Tinker, if I seem to violate the confidence of my customers. But I think that it is a great shame that the Lord Lavendale should so completely disappear. I am a Sicilian myself, but I know a little island close by our country called Rosario, and when I supervised the table, I overheard the Lord Lavendale accept the invitation of the young man with the ginger hair to visit Rosario on that day. I think the young man is an aviator or something, but at the time I did not consider the conversation important. Perhaps you and the so great Mr. Sexton Blake will be able to put two and two together. For me, I am maître d'hôtel and, alas, no detective.
Tinker smiled. The information he had gleaned, although meagre, was interesting. The fate of the missing man was undoubtedly linked up in some mysterious fashion with the tiny little island republic in the Mediterranean. He pondered deeply over the problem as he was whirled back in a taxi to Baker Street. Blake seemed not to have moved a muscle during the whole time of his absence, but sat smoking with calm reflection his battered briar pipe. Tinker told him briefly the facts that he had gathered. Sexton Blake remained thoughtful.
I think a little trip would be good for us, Tinker. I have a certain instinct, a certain intuition, call it what you will, that this case is going to be simpler than it appears on the surface. Ring up the Croydon Aerodrome and book two seats for 10 o'clock tomorrow by the De Lesseps air taxi. A change of air would do us good.
Tinker grinned.
Where are you thinking of going to, Governor?
Blake smiled inscrutably.
Rosario, my boy.
You going to look for Lord Lavendale?
Asked Tinker in amazement. Blake nodded.
Yes,
and maybe Professor Llewellyn's missing microbes. File 6. The next morning, Sexton Blake and Tinker were abroad at 9 o'clock, after retiring at an unusually early hour the previous evening. Mrs. Vardell, Blake's worthy housekeeper, raised up her hands in horror as Tinker explained that they were going for a little flying trip to the continent.
"Lord some mercy, Mr. Tinker," she said. "By area planes ain't safe. What with them electric currents, side skids and firms which float about the atmosphere, which, as I used to say to the late Mr. Bardell, if nature had intended man to smoke, she would have provided him with a chimney. The same as we were expected to fly. We'd have had wings. However, poor dear Bardell's got his now, at least I hope, and an heart as well.
Tinker smiled. He was genuinely fond of Mrs. Bardell and her motherly concern. While it amused him, it also heightened the bond of affection which had existed for so many years between the housekeeper and himself. "Oh, don't you worry about us, Mrs. Bardell. We'll be as right as rain. 4 hours, think of it. That's all it will take to get to the coast of Italy. And then for the sunshine after this grisly London weather." He glanced through the window at the misty murk of a typical morning in late winter. "Captain Briscoe of the Aero Taxi Company is going to pilot us, Governor," he said. As Sexton Blake hurried into the room, his tall athletic frame warmly wrapped in a leather coat.
"Good."
The great detective nodded his approval.
"He's a capable man, Briscoe. Shouldn't take us more than 4 hours to get across. Got the bags?"
Tinker nodded.
They ring the car outside, Governor."
A moment later came the wheezy, discordant wail of some long-forgotten Neapolitan tune from the street below.
"Oh, there's that dratty Italian again, Mr. Blake. 3 times this morning he's been round at his house, a-churning out of his macaroni and spaghetti tunes. What with their monkeys and their ice creams and their anchovies, they ought to be comported, every one of them."
The suspicion of a smile lurked round the corners of Sexton Blake's firm, well-chiselled lips, and he glanced casually out of the window to where the Italian organ grinder, dressed in a faded velveteen jacket and a black, low-crowned hat, was standing.
"We'll shoo him away for you, Mrs. Bardell," grinned Tinker, as he seized the travelling rug. "Goodbye. We'll be back in a few days."
Mrs. Bardell, as behoved the housekeeper of a world-renowned detective, was used to Blake's erratic ways, and with a final injunction to Tinker to take care in them dratted aeroplanes, she disappeared into the dim, mysterious quarters in the basement over which she reigned supreme. Sexton Blake took the wheel, and a moment later the car slid forward in the direction of Croydon. Tinker was silent as his governor threaded his way through the traffic at the end of Baker Street. If he had not been so preoccupied with conjecture regarding the outcome of Blake's hurried dash to Croydon, he would have noticed that, as the car left the house in Baker Street, the Italian organ grinder began to play the little lilting Neapolitan tune in quick tempo. The gay, catchy little air, redolent of the sunny south, seemed to be a little out of place in the busy but drab thoroughfare of Baker Street. With a final flourish of his handle and a jerk at the chain that held the gibbering monkey on the edge of the organ, the Italian moved on after one slow, keen glance up at the windows of Blake's consulting room. Then he trudged on, but there was a glint of quiet satisfaction in his shifty black eyes as he noticed a motorcyclist, heavily goggled, speeding through the roaring traffic in a seeming endeavour to overtake Sexton Blake's car. Little did Blake or Tinker realise what tangled skein of mystery lay behind the visit of Professor Llewellyn and the disreputable organ grinder who trudged on his way with a decrepit barrel organ and a mangy monkey.
File 7.
It was punctually at 10 o'clock when Blake drew up at the Croydon aerodrome. Captain Briscoe, the once famous flying ace, and now the crack pilot of the Aero Taxi Company, greeted Blake warmly as the detective stepped out of his motor car, accompanied by Tinker.
"Good morning, Briscoe,"
said Blake cordially.
All fit and ready for our little trip?
Quite okay, Mr. Blake. We should reach Rosario, all being well, by 2:30 or thereabouts. We'll get there via Marseille and pass over at the seaport about 12. I'd be glad to get out of this foggy weather.
He coughed and tapped his chest.
A little of the sunny Riviera air would do the old lungs good.
Blake nodded, while Tinker attended to the luggage and garaged the motor car at an adjacent hangar.
You, of course, want a return trip, do you not, Mr. Blake?
Said Briscoe.
Sexton Blake took out a cigarette case and proffered it to the flying officer. Very probably we shall return tomorrow. I don't think my inquiries will take long. On the other hand, there's no knowing what will happen. Is anyone else accompanying you on this journey?
No, Mr. Blake. You're the only passengers. Rosario's such an out-of-the-way place that I get very little demand for trips there.
Tinker, having emerged victorious from a wordy tussle with the customs authorities, appeared at this point and followed Blake and the airman as they climbed aboard the plane. As the mechanic swung the propeller, a motorcyclist, dressed in a close-fitting Burberry and a leather cap, glared at them from the safe seclusion of a wooden hut just beyond the railed-off public enclosure. Unnoticed by anybody, he dismounted from the machine, kicked down the rear wheel stand, and watched the preparations that were being made for the flight in the middle of the grassy aerodrome. The propeller was revving erratically by this time, and the engine emitting a series of loud and irregular explosions. Soon the engine warmed to its work, and the revolutions became steady and constant. Then, with an increasing roar, the machine lurched and bumped across the uneven ground, skimmed the surface, rose clear, and began to climb, circling for height. Those below watched it as it dwindled steadily into the blue above, and only ceased interest in it when it had diminished to a little speck and had headed out on its course for the south. There was a grim smile about the lips of the mysterious motorcyclist as he looked earthwards again. Then, leaving his machine propped up in the roadway, he sauntered across to the aerodrome post office, an unambitious structure that was concerned not only with His Majesty's mail, but also with the retailing of fruit, sweets, and postcards. "Now, Mr. Sexton Blake," he muttered, as he approached the wire-grilled counter at the end of the shop, "we'll see if the speed of an aeroplane can be outmatched. We've long memories, you know." Then, asking for a foreign telegram form, he set to work composing a very cryptic telegram.
File 8.
Tinker was no flying novice, but he was still young enough to gaze down with delight at the foam-capped breakers of the English Channel as the plane skimmed southwards under the capable hands of the pilot. Soon the sea gave place to land again. They were flying an even 70 miles an hour, but when the coast of France was reached, the throbbing engines took on a more sonorous tone. Down below them stretched the rich brown earth of France, fresh from the plough's blade, specked here and there by the brilliant red roofs of little hamlets and villages. Then, eventually, came the sea again, and Tinker gazed down with interest at the congested harbour of Marseille, with the foreshortened masts of tall-topped ships. In the distance, across the harbour, loomed the rugged, grim pile of Chateau d'If, the romantic prison from which the Count of Monte Cristo escaped after 14 weary years. Blake pointed out various places rich in historical associations to the lad as the aeroplane hummed southwards on the Riviera coast. Tinker gazed down at the broad, smooth, white walks of Monte Carlo, bounded by green-fronded palms. They were flying at too great an altitude to recognize any ordinary buildings, but the shining domes of the casino glittered like golden apples in the sun. Blake glanced at his watch as the aeroplane hummed over a stretch of some 30 miles of Mediterranean sea, which shimmered and glowed like a gigantic sapphire. "Soon be there now, Tinker, my lad," he said. "I believe that although the country has fallen into decay since the war, there are still one or two decent hotels there." His dexterous hands on the controls, Captain Briscoe, with the ease born of long practice, spiraled, then volplaned gracefully downwards to what seemed a facet of purest green set in that sapphire sea. The landing was perfect, and Tinker stepped out of the aeroplane, followed by Sexton Blake, as a scurry of excited Rosarians surrounded the machine. "You'd better come along and have lunch with us," said Blake to Briscoe, as a fat little gendarme bustled forward. "I suppose no one will pinch the bus." He turned to the gendarme and spoke rapidly in French. The policeman nodded vigorously several times.
"But certainly, monsieur, I can quite understand. In a few minutes I will put the guard round the aeroplane."
Very tactfully, Blake thrust a French note into the gendarme's podgy palm. Tinker stared down the quaint white roadway that twisted and turned like a dragon's writhing tail up and down the rocky slopes of Rosario. Perched on the rock were buildings that seemed to have been carved out of ivory, so glittering white they seemed against the turquoise sky. 1,000 feet below, the Mediterranean wish-washed against the rugged boulders of the foreshore.
"We're not far from the town, I imagine," said Sexton Blake. "The domes over there are, I think, part of the casino. This used to be a very popular pleasure resort before the war. Crowds who had grown blasé with Monte Carlo came over to this little island. It's had a remarkable history, and the scenery on the other side is really superb. The vineyards are rich, and semi-tropical fruit grows in abundance." They walked about a quarter of a mile down the roadway, and soon entered the outskirts of Rosario's one and only town. It was the poorer quarter of the city, and Tinker was reminded vaguely of the mean quarters of Veracruz, or the native bazaars of old Damascus. The shops were huddled together in astonishing confusion. There did not seem to be any windows, although great piles and pyramids of apples, golden oranges, and luscious purple grapes lent vivid patches of colour to their sombre background.
"It has changed," said Briscoe as he lit a cigarette. "Before the war, the promenade on the other side of the city was thronged with the most fashionable people in society."
"Well, I hope the hotels are existent at least," said Sexton Blake.
I know where we are now."
The narrow street turned abruptly into a series of steps, hewn out of the solid rock. They climbed these laboriously and approached a smooth, gleaming promenade. Its surface of granite glistened with facets, as if from a million diamonds in the warm Riviera sun. The promenade was flanked by waving masses of palms, and imposing casinos and hotels rose above green lawns.
"We'll
Try the Hotel Splendide,
said Briscoe.
I stayed here about 7 years ago.
He led the way up a flight of steps onto an awning-covered terrace, crowded with a gay, laughing throng of chattering Rosarians. Blake's keen eyes noticed that there seemed to be no Englishman present, and as they entered the hotel, the proprietor gazed at the three with a look of mingled surprise and delight. Blake ordered lunch without vouchsafing any further information regarding the length of his stay. As they sat down to an excellent repast in the crowded palm court, Tinker stared across the room, then gave vent to a cry of astonishment.
"Good Lord, Governor! Look! There's Mr. Tom Gunn! And, as I live, with him, it's Lord Lavendale!"
Blake looked up and instantly recognised the sturdy Labour MP and the well-known sporting peer. Then he chuckled quietly.
"Well, that solves mystery number two," he said.
"I think I'll invite his lordship and his friend to lunch with us."
He rose to his feet and strode across to the two Britishers.
"This is an unexpected pleasure," he drawled, and held out his hand. "Great Scott! It's Sexton Blake! What the hell are you doing in Rosario?"
The detective laughed.
"Considering that the whole of England has been talking about your disappearance, I think the answer is self-evident." "Our disappearance?"
The peer's voice was puzzled, and he arched his eyebrows interrogatively.
"What do you mean?"
Sexton Blake piloted them across to the luncheon table, and as the two sat down, he drew from his pocket a copy of that morning's paper. Lord Lavendale and his friends scanned the heavily inked lines with a look of blank astonishment on their faces.
"But, great heavens, Mr. Blake,"
said Tom Gunn explosively,
"what's the meaning of all this rot? We left London Monday night. We've been in Rosario less than 48 hours.
Sexton Blake smiled inscrutably, and there was a gleam of mischief in his grey eyes.
"I'm sorry to contradict you, gentlemen, but you left London 6 days ago."
He leant forward confidentially.
"May I ask you what you've been doing since then?"
File 9.
For a moment, the peer gazed at Blake with a look of hopeless bewilderment in his rather dreamy blue eyes.
"Oh, look here, Mr. Blake,"
broke in the bluff Labour leader gruffly.
"Do you mean to insinuate that we're lying?"
Sexton Blake coughed.
"I should hesitate a good deal before coming to that conclusion," he said. "But there you have the facts. You're quite at liberty to affirm or deny them."
Lord Lavendale read the news item, then replaced the paper on the table with a weary gesture.
"We arrived here last night, Mr. Blake, by one of the Continental Airlines."
He broke off suddenly and viewed the newspaper again and glanced at the date.
"Oh, great heavens! It's Saturday. I was under the impression that today was Wednesday."
The peer ran his fingers in a puzzled fashion through his mop of curly chestnut hair. Sexton Blake frowned thoughtfully and scanned the peer's face shrewdly. Was the nobleman lying to cover up some secret plan?
"Where is the aeroplane now, Lord Lavendale?"
he asked at length.
"It returned to San Remo this morning. We intended to cross over to the mainland by the packet boat tonight,
and then catch the PLM Express to Paris.
Tinker and Briscoe looked at each other in bewilderment, and then the youngster rose to his feet.
If you'll excuse us, Governor, Captain Briscoe and I feel like a little stroll, he said, with a meaning glance.
Blake nodded as Tinker strolled down the terrace with his thoroughly mystified companion.
Have you any theory to account for this amazing state of affairs, Mr. Blake?
Pleaded the Labour MP.
Surely it's preposterous to imagine a man losing 4 whole days out of his life without noticing it. I could understand if we'd been ill or unconscious.
He thumped his chest aggressively.
I feel as fit as a fiddle. And Lord Lavendale here, well, does he look like an invalid?
Blake smiled faintly.
It was difficult to imagine one less like an invalid than the beefy, good-humoured peer. If it is not violating any confidence, may I ask what brought you to Rosario, gentlemen? He said.
Lord Lavendale coughed and paused for a moment.
As a matter of fact, Mr. Blake, we're here partly on business and partly on pleasure. I brought my very good friend Mr. Tom Gunn with me because he had certain plans to discuss, and I thought he would appreciate a couple of days of southern sunshine after a very strenuous session.
Sexton Blake pursed his lips thoughtfully.
Have your visit any connection with Mr. Mike Malone's luncheon party at Pomano's?
Lord Lavendale's jaw dropped, and his prominent eyes almost goggled as he gasped out in astonishment,
Great Scott, Blake! You're uncanny! How ever did you discover that Malone was our host, or that he had anything to do with Rosario?
The criminologist smiled enigmatically.
Nevertheless, I'm afraid the connection is my secret for the moment, went on Lord Lavendale.
Blake's manner changed abruptly.
Oh, come, gentlemen, put your cards on the table. On Monday last, you lunched with Mr. Michael Malone. You state that you've been here just 48 hours. The problem is, where were you on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday?
Oh, blessed if I know, said Lavendale. I could have sworn today was Tuesday.
Precisely, continued Blake. He half closed his eyes and pressed the tips of his long, lean fingers together. I think it's obvious that some person or persons had an interest in keeping you in Rosario longer than you intended to stay. I've not sufficient data as yet to elucidate the mystery, unless you inform me why you came to Rosario. Lord Lavendale glanced inquiringly at Tom Gunn, who nodded assent.
Well, Mr. Blake, Michael Malone is the accredited agent of the Rosarian government. He approached me 6 months ago with a scheme for exploiting Rosario as a pleasure resort and restoring its pre-war gaiety so as to rival Monte Carlo. After thoroughly going into the financial side of the question, I invested £250,000 in Rosarian government securities. The casinos, promenades, and hotels have already been renovated, and we're about to launch an immense publicity scheme throughout the world.
Blake was thoughtful. I see. Then you simply came here on Monday last to confer with the directors of the casino.
Well, that's all, Mr. Blake. And just to look around and see how the place was progressing,
said Lord Lavendale.
After all, one is rather interested as to whether one's money is being handled properly.
Quite.
And you, Mr. Gunn?
Blake turned to the Labour leader. Tom Gunn coughed.
Well, I'm here purely as a guest of Lord Lavendale, he said. I felt a little run down, and I thought that 2 days in the South here would do me good. As a socialist, I must admit I'm not in favour of some of his schemes, but as a friend I have the very heartiest admiration for Lord Lavendale.
Blake nodded.
Would you mind telling me whether Mr. Michael Malone accompanied you on this trip?
No. No, he stayed in London. He's acting as a kind of unofficial consul at the moment, said the peer.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Sexton Blake rose to his feet.
I think I shall be able to give you some interesting information shortly. I suppose you intend to return tonight? The boat leaves, I believe, at 6 o'clock.
Oh, most decidedly, said Tom Gunn. Why, they'll be frantic at my absence.
Say, Lord Lavendale, how goes it? Drawled a nasal transatlantic voice.
Blake swung round on his heel and faced the burly, broad-shouldered man dressed in white ducks with a dazzlingly white toupee. The stranger's face was tanned, and his shrewd eyes peered in an oddly bird-like fashion through an enormous pair of tortoiseshell-rimmed spectacles. The peer smiled and shook hands with the stranger.
Pray meet Mr. Brian Bruce, Mr. Blake. He's our publicity expert, and the only American citizen in Rosario.
I'm glad to meet you, Mr. Blake, because the whole world has heard about you. You don't need a publicity man.
Blake smiled and extended his hand courteously. That's very kind of you, he said.
Oh, what do you think of our little old island, Mr. Blake? Asked Bruce.
I hardly know. Blake shrugged his shoulders. I've been here just an hour or two.
I'm calling this the island where time stood still. In my next posters, Mr. Blake.
Gee whiz, the days here pass as swift as highballs down a man's throat in a prohibition country.
Lavendale laughed.
Well, there's something in that, Bruce. When did we arrive here?
For a fraction of a second, the publicity man hesitated.
Why, 2 days ago, I guess. Or was it yesterday? Oh, one day's so like another in this place. Yes, this is the only original Garden of Eden, Mr. Blake.
Tom Gunn guffawed heartily.
You can't keep Mr. Bruce from boasting Rosario, Mr. Blake. He's certainly got his heart in the job.
Sexton Blake glanced keenly at the square, rugged face of the American.
It's rather curious that you should mention the passage of time in this island, Mr. Bruce, he said thoughtfully.
As a matter of fact, there's no little mystery attached to the time element here.
Why, what do you mean, Mr. Blake?
The publicity man's voice was startled.
Now, it looks as if,
broke in Lord Lavendale,
the whole of England is upset about our absence. Do you know what day it is today?
The American scratched his chin thoughtfully.
I'm darned if I do. I feel rather like that guy Robinson Crusoe on his island. He never seemed to realize what the date was. This kind of afflicted me in the same way.
Take a look at that, said Sexton Blake, and handed him a copy of the morning paper. The American scanned the scare headlines, his eyes agleam.
Say, some story, Mr. Blake. Darned if I know how it happened, but I'll get the cables right now. It'll be a fine publicity stunt for Rosario. Excuse me.
He touched his topi and swung on his heel. The trio watched the broad-shouldered athletic figure as he strode down the terrace onto the promenade.
"Well, he's a rum bird, but very efficient," said Lavendale.
"Yes, very." Blake's eyes narrowed a little. He had made a pretty shrewd estimate of the American's character.
"You're going to stay here, Mr. Blake, or will you return with us?"
asked Tom Gunn.
Blake yawned. "As a matter of fact, there's more than one reason for my visit to Rosario, gentlemen," he said. "The mystery of your whereabouts has happily been solved, but there's yet much work to be done."
Lavendale glanced curiously at the criminologist.
"Ah, well, Mr. Blake, it's a puzzling business. But, you know, ever since I've been in Rosario, I've felt that nothing much matters. I feel rather like a lotus eater."
"Yeah, and I too," added the Labour leader.
"So now the prospect of returning to England is not particularly alluring. However, our duty is clear, and this evening we shall return by the packet boat to the mainland."
Blake noticed the slim young figure of Tinker, accompanied by Briscoe, at the end of the terrace.
"Pardon me, gentlemen," he said. "I'll see you later."
He strolled over to where the lad was sitting, sipping a huge iced drink in the shadow of a green palm tree.
"Hello, Governor."
Tinker looked up.
"What sort of giddy mystery?"
Blake shook his head and sat down. He was more than usually thoughtful. Suddenly, he turned to the lad.
"What time is it now, Tinker?"
The boy looked at his wristwatch.
"Why, it's nearly 4 o'clock. I thought it was about 2.
He added in surprise. Sexton Blake glanced sharply at the boy.
"Do you experience any curious sensation here, Tinker?"
he said.
"No, nothing at all, Governor."
Tinker looked up, puzzled.
"We've just been having a stroll round. We called at the pump house at the back of the hotel and had a drink, that messy water, and just strolled back here."
"Pump house?" said Sexton Blake.
"Yes," put in Briscoe. "One of the main attractions before the war in Rosario was the wonderful Chalybeate Springs. They've some of the strongest natural waters in the world. Tinker and I sampled one a little while ago."
Sexton Blake frowned and lit his pipe. Suddenly, there came a whining sound, and something whizzed past his head with a flash and buried itself in the palm tree. Blake jerked to his feet. Then he started, for quivering in the trunk of the palm tree was a thin, pointed dagger.
"Great Scott, Governor! What the—"
Blake took the blade in his long, sensitive fingers and saw that a slip of paper was attached to the hilt. He unrolled it slowly. On it, scrawled in blood-red letters, were the words, "We have long memories. This is our first and final warning." Beneath this cryptic message was the rude symbol of a black hand. File 10.
"Good heavens, Governor!"
Tinker's face was serious and sober as he read the message over Blake's shoulder.
"What's the idea of all this mystery? Who on earth knows that you've arrived in Rosario?"
Blake's lips set grimly, and his lean jaw tense like a steel trap. "I don't know, Tinker," he said gruffly.
but it's evidently someone who's pretty daring. No one seemed to have noticed the swift flight of the blade on the terrace, except the trio, for the crowd of gaily dressed Brazarians went on drinking and chattering without concern. Blake glanced at the tree, and then at the crowd of people. He took a sheet of paper out of his pocket and rapidly scribbled a diagram on it. Then he smiled a little bitterly. The fellow got away quickly. Call the waiter, Tinker.
Why, do you know who threw the knife, Governor?
Asked the youngster in bewilderment.
Why, you had your back to the terrace. How on earth did you... You got eyes in the back of your head?
Bring the waiter over here, snapped Blake crisply. Wondering, Tinker crossed over to where a waiter was busy dispensing drinks. Captain Briscoe looked concerned.
Oh, you're having a fine start, Mr. Blake. It's hardly what I'd call a nice welcome to Rosario.
Blake smiled grimly.
I don't fear this unknown marksman, Briscoe, he said. I'm not to be terrorized by childish threats like these.
Yes, sir?
The Rosarian waiter rubbed his hands obsequiously as he came up to Blake.
Ah!
Blake spoke rapidly in French.
You were serving a gentleman at the table over there.
He pointed to a little marble-topped table on which reposed an empty absinthe glass.
May we?
Replied the waiter.
Is he a regular customer? Oh, he comes here sometimes, sir, but not very often.
Do you happen to know his name?
It is Pedro Negretti, sir. He's the keeper of the Fantan Saloon in the Rue Scribe.
Thank you. Blake's voice was stern. Stay here, Tinker. I shall be back shortly.
I'm going to take a little stroll, he said.
The youngster looked mystified, but he was too used to Blake's habits to question him.
Right you are, Governor,
he assented cheerfully.
Captain Briscoe and I'll go smoke in the lounge.
Blake strode swiftly down the terrace onto the promenade, after inquiring the way to the Rue Scribe.
Wonder what the Governor's up to now,
said Tinker to Briscoe.
It's been nothing but one maze of puzzles for the last 2 days.
Captain Briscoe nodded. The whole thing to him seemed fantastic and unreal. Sexton Blake, his face grim and purposeful, strode swiftly down the promenade until he approached the straggling native quarter of the Rue Scribe. The shopkeepers looked curiously at him, but he did not pause until he neared a garishly painted cabaret sandwiched between a dingy-looking café and a curiosity shop. Over the door, in letters of faded gold, were the words, Fantan Saloon. Blake entered. The place was full of evil-looking Rosarians of the lower class, and the room was thick with clouds of rank tobacco smoke. The customers slammed dominoes and dice in little staccato raps on the dingy marble-topped tables, and at Blake's entrance there fell a sudden silence.
"Where is Monsieur Negretti?"
the detective demanded of a slant-eyed waiter who hovered at the entrance. The Chinaman jerked his head towards the counter at the other end of the room.
"Him in there, sir," he said.
"Right, I'll go and see him."
Blake strode down the aisle, heedless of the malevolent glances of the tough-looking mob of Rosarians.
"Monsieur Negretti," he snapped.
The man behind the counter was a fat, bloated person with a stubble of beard ornamenting his oily, unhealthy face.
"Well, what do you want?" "Monsieur Negretti is busy," said the barman.
"Tell him Sexton Blake wishes to see him," snapped the criminologist. "And quick about it." The barman's three chins quivered, jelly-like, at the rasping command.
"Certainly, sir."
He slipped down with an unaccustomed agility from his bar stool, opened the curtained doorway at the back of the bar, and disappeared for a few minutes. Sexton Blake glanced contemptuously at the drink-sodden riff-raff in the saloon. A little later, the fat barman returned.
"Monsieur Negretti presents his compliments, and would you be so good as to join him in a little drink in his private saloon? It is so crowded here."
He pulled aside the curtain. Blake squared his shoulders and entered a long, narrow passage. There was a thin beam of amber light filtering from an open doorway, which illuminated a luxuriously furnished room.
"Come right in, Mr. Blake,"
called a voice in English, with a faint hint of a foreign accent.
"I'm coming in, Mr. Negretti. I want a word with you," said Blake.
As he did so, he felt a staggering blow at the back of his head. His hand flew to his hip pocket, but before he could withdraw his revolver, he felt a second crashing blow over the side of his temple. His senses reeled. He clutched convulsively at some unseen assailant. A red mist, flecked with violet spots, danced before his eyes, and a great roaring sounded in his ears. Then consciousness left him, snapped out as one snaps out an electric light switch.
File 11.
"What's happened to everybody?"
Tinker looked at his watch in alarm. It was 3 hours after Blake's sudden departure from the hotel terrace. He and Captain Briscoe had taken a walk to the beautiful medieval castle that crowned the rocky peak of Rosario, and they were now, in evening dress, awaiting Blake's belated return to the hotel.
"What a governor should have been back some time ago."
"Didn't like him," said Tinker.
"Didn't like him to be away so long without letting me know. And where the deuce are Lord Lavendale and Mr. Tom Gunn?"
Captain Briscoe shook his head.
"I don't know. I haven't seen Mr. Blake, but I understand that his lordship and the Labour leader returned to the mainland by the 6 o'clock packet boat."
"Blessed if I can make it out," said Tinker.
"Ought to be a rare old how-d'ye-do when they get back to England, after playing truant for more than a week."
Captain Briscoe smiled.
"Ah, that's the penalty of being famous, Tinker, my lad," he said. "If it was you or me now, the papers wouldn't kick up any fuss." "Oh, don't you be too sure of that,"
smiled Tinker. He puffed his chest out and laughed.
"England would be up in arms if they lost me."
Briscoe snorted.
"Who's the American guy over there?"
he said, as the portly figure of Brian Bruce crossed the palm court of the hotel.
"Best if I know," said Tinker. "He was talking to the governor a little while ago."
"Good evening, gentlemen," drawled Brian Bruce. "You seen anything of Mr. Sexton Blake?"
Tinker shook his head.
"No, I was just wondering what had become of him. I'm getting rather hungry. It's about time we had dinner."
"Oh, you're Mr. Tinker, I presume,"
said Brian Bruce with a smile. Tinker nodded, and introduced his companion.
Say, will you have a cigar?
Said the American, proffering his case.
Come up to my room for a chat and an appetizer before dinner.
Tinker accepted.
Oh, thanks very much.
And, accompanied by Briscoe, they followed the American up the wide staircase to a suite on the first floor that was almost regal in its magnificence. Bruce brought out a decanter and a siphon, and Briscoe helped himself.
"Well, what brings you to this part of the world, Mr. Tinker?"
Bruce asked. Tinker looked at him keenly and said very cautiously,
I'm here with Mr. Blake on just a short visit.
Well, drawled the American,
I hope when you get back to England you'll give our little island a good boost. I'm a publicity man myself, and I believe in advertising. This place will be like fairyland in a few months' time when we get busy with our improvements.
Tell me, said Tinker abruptly, do you know anything about the King of Rosario?
Brian Bruce started.
Nope. I guess Rosario's like God's own country, a republic. We don't have much truck with royalty.
No, I was just wondering,
said Tinker. The American looked at him keenly through his horn-rimmed spectacles.
That's a curious kind of question to ask, young man, he said. Where'd you get that idea?
Tinker smiled.
Oh, I don't know much about the customs of this country. I thought maybe you had a monarchy here.
He changed the conversation adroitly, but there lurked at the back of his mind a vague suspicion of the plausible, smooth-tongued American. A few minutes later, there came the sound of a gong, and the American rose to his feet.
Well, I guess I can do with a bite to eat, young fellow, he said. Will you both join me at dinner?
Delighted,
murmured the others. The American led the way. Tinker's keen young eyes took a final rapid survey of the room. He paused for a fraction of a second at an open writing desk, for on the pad of the blotting paper reposed an unstamped, addressed envelope. The youngster whistled below his breath, for the address on the letter was Mr. Michael Malone, Hotel Olympic, London, England.
Mr. Blooming Bruce, so you're at the back of this business,
muttered Tinker, as he followed his host down to the dining room. He looked anxiously in the hallway for Sexton Blake's familiar figure, but the manager shrugged his shoulders politely.
No, Mr. Blake has not returned, sir. I expect he will be back shortly.
The three sat down to dine. Tinker watched the American narrowly, but Brian Bruce seemed to be full of good spirits and bubbled over with light and amusing conversation. In spite of the vague anxiety, Tinker was forced to laugh at the quaint transatlantic stories which Bruce told with immense vim and zest. He was watching him carefully, however. Dinner over, there was still no sign of Sexton Blake. By this time, Tinker was thoroughly alarmed.
Say, Briscoe, I don't like the look of this at all, he said. Let's go and see if we can find the governor.
The young airman nodded.
I'm quite game. You surely don't suspect any foul play, Tinker. Where did he go?
Tinker pursed his lips thoughtfully.
I'll ask the waiter. You're forgotten,
he said, and crossed over.
Then, come on, Briscoe. You got your gun?
He looks as if it's a tough joint from what the waiter says.
Briscoe patted his hip pocket.
Sure, I never go without it. It's as well to be prepared for a scrap.
By now night had fallen. A warm, tropical evening, languorous with the odours of the Mediterranean. The sky was like a robe of violet velvet, on which the stars glittered and twinkled like golden sequins. Tinker took in deep gulps of the air and sighed.
Ah, it's a wonderful evening, Briscoe. Think of it. It's probably foggy and raining in good old London now.
The airman smiled.
Yes, I suppose it is. That's a nasty-looking quarter, this,
he added, as they approached the Rue Scribe. Tinker advanced cautiously, and halted suddenly outside the illuminated entrance to the Fantan Saloon.
Well, this is the place the waiter said, he remarked. If the governor's in there, then we'll probably have to fight to get him out.
As they entered the vile atmosphere of the gambling saloon, there came a murmur of conversation.
In we get, said Tinker, briskly, and we'll ask for the jolly old proprietor.
At their approach, a tall man with sleek, oily hair plastered low over his forehead and a pair of heavy gold earrings barred their entrance.
"What is it you want, monsieur?"
he asked. Tinker looked defiantly at him.
"Has Mr. Sexton Blake been here?"
"Sexton Blake? Who is he?"
demanded the other, who was obviously the proprietor.
"He's a friend of ours,"
said Tinker, somewhat nonplussed. The other's shifty eyes looked at him with an evil glance.
"I ask again, what can I do for you, young gentleman?"
"Is your name Negretti?"
demanded Tinker.
"Yes, that is my name. I am the proprietor of this saloon."
"Then you lie,"
said Tinker, chancing all on a bold shot.
"What have you done with Mr. Blake? We won't leave here until you tell us where he's gone."
"That's the stuff to give him, youngster,"
whispered Captain Briscoe, his eyes sparkling with excitement, his muscles nerved and tense for the inevitable scrap.
"I tell you, I know no one of that name,"
replied Negretti vehemently.
You must get outside if you do not want to drink or gamble."
A party of evil-looking Rosarians had stopped their chatter at an adjacent table and were staring at the two Britishers with avaricious eyes. Tinker cautiously drew out his automatic and pressed it against the proprietor's stomach.
"Now will you answer?"
he said. Negretti's unwholesome face grew pasty. He shrieked out,
"Miguel! Cat!"
Then things happened. A glass whizzed past Tinker's head, missing him by a fraction of an inch, and crashed into a thousand silvery splinters on the opposite wall, leaving a crimson mark of wine that ran down in an ominous blood-red stream. With a howl of fury, the group of employees whirled themselves upon the two Britishers.
"Shoot at the lights!"
gasped Tinker. Bang! Bang! Immediately his automatic began to crack out in a swift fusillade of shots, and two lights out of four went out. Presently the other two winked out also, the targets of Tinker's friend. The saloon became one shrieking pandemonium of sound. There came groans and shrill screams,
punctuated by the staccato crack, crack of the Britishers' guns.
Stick by me, Tinker,
said Briscoe, as he hurled his broad shoulders against the struggling mass of Rosarians in the darkness.
Come on, laddie, let him have it.
Crash! They lurched against the table. The marble slab broke in pieces on the asphalt floor. Tinker had fired all his cartridges, and he picked up a broken fragment of stone and hurled it with all his force at where he believed the fighting Rosarians to be. Suddenly, Briscoe jerked out,
It's our bare fists now. My gun's empty. Let them have it, laddie.
Tinker, panting and disheveled, was struggling furiously with some unseen assailant in the darkness. He felt a vicious slash at his shins, and then he grunted as he felt the crunch of a skull against the butt of his revolver.
Ouch!
He could hear the sudden cry of his assailant as he dropped limply to the floor, and he smiled grimly. Briscoe was acquitting himself well. His arms whirled like flails, and his knuckles were torn and bleeding from contact with many unshaven Rosarian chins. Suddenly, another revolver shot sounded through the darkness. Tinker felt a stab of pain in his left shoulder.
Oh, God! They got me, Briscoe!
He shouted. Then his heart gave a sudden leap of joy, for a deep, familiar voice shouted out, Hold on, Tinker! I'm coming!
The governor!
Gasped the lad.
The governor!
There was a sob of thankfulness in his voice.
Sexton Blake!
Said Briscoe. It was impossible to distinguish in that roaring dark friend from foe, but suddenly a great yellow beam of light flashed out, cutting through the gloom like a golden dagger. In its rays, Tinker caught a fleeting glimpse of Sexton Blake's tall, athletic figure, and a swift glance of a struggling mass of humanity. Crashed his fists into the face of one man, grabbed him by the throat, and flung him off. A moment later, Sexton Blake was at his side. This way, said Blake. I still have four chambers left.
Bang!
The automatic spurted a tongue of flame through the darkness, and the three Britishers, wedged firmly together, cut their way through the struggling Rosarians until they reached the doorway. As he felt the cool night air fanning his face, Tinker breathed a sob of thankfulness. In the street outside, there was a frenzied crowd and the shrill beep of police whistles. Sexton Blake shrugged his shoulders. Oh, the fight'll die down shortly. Let 'em beat each other up in the darkness. Tinker, I, for one, will be glad of a wash and something to eat.
Oh, thank heavens you're alive, Governor,
said Tinker gaspingly. Blake's face was white and strained. There was an ugly patch of dried blood on his temple, and he smiled wanly. Then his face grew concerned again.
Oh, good heavens, laddie, you're hit,
he said, and put an arm tenderly round Tinker's shoulders. By the light of a street lamp, he took off the youngster's coat and tore away his blood-stained dress shirt.
Oh, thank goodness, it's only a flesh wound. I bet it aches abominably, but it'll soon heal, my lad, he said.
I seem to be the only one unscathed, said Briscoe with a smile.
Oh, gee, that was some scrap, Mr. Blake. I don't know what it's about, but then I'm Irish, you see, and I like scraps where everyone can join in.
Sexton Blake laughed.
Thank you both, he said simply. Let's go back to the hotel, and I'll tell you all that's happened.
File 12.
an hour later, refreshed by a warm bath and the ministrations of the hotel doctor, Sexton Blake sat back in a comfortable armchair. Tinker, clad in a borrowed silk dressing gown of a weird and wonderful pattern, his wounded shoulder still throbbing painfully beneath the tight white bandages, listened with eager interest as the detective gave an account of his visit to the Fantan Saloon. Captain Briscoe's bronzed face was still flushed after the fray, but he followed Blake's story with keen appreciation as he puffed at a cigar.
"Well, it was really quite a simple piece of deduction," explained the criminologist easily. "It was not a particularly difficult feat to discover who hurled that murderous-looking dagger at my head."
"But, Governor, how on earth did you manage to spot him?" queried Tinker. "You had your back to the hotel terrace, and..."
Sexton Blake smiled.
"When I was at school, Tinker," he said reminiscently, "we had an old mathematics master who was as blind as a bat without his spectacles. One day, when he was drawing a diagram of a blackboard, a boy threw a piece of chalk at him and missed. The chalk hit the blackboard and left a mark. Immediately, the master turned round and roared out, 'You threw that chalk!' and pointed at the guilty boy. At the time, I was just as mystified as you are now. But later, I learned that it was just a question of geometry. It is possible, by a little thought, to trace the angle of a thrown object straight to the thrower. Now the rest is elementary."
"Well, I'm blessed, Mr. Blake," broke in Bristow heartily. "I'm pretty good at geometry myself, but I never thought it could be applied to crime."
Sexton Blake leaned back in his chair. His eyelids drooped for a fleeting instant.
"The really successful criminologist, my dear Briscoe," he said, "is one that can apply any art or science to deductive reasoning. I have on occasion found Mrs. Beaton's cookery book extremely helpful when unravelling a poison mystery."
Briscoe laughed shortly.
"But what on earth was that murderous ruffian's idea, Mr. Blake?" he asked. "However did he develop such a fanatical hatred of you at once? He'd only been in Rosario a few hours." "I learned all about Negretti's grievance in the course of a somewhat one-sided discussion in his back parlour," replied Sexton Blake. "I'm afraid I must admit I was a bit careless. Some ruffian caught me unawares as I entered Negretti's sanctum, and I was knocked out. When I came to, it was to find myself securely tied to a dirty camp bedstead, and entirely at the mercy of the villainous proprietor of the Fantan Saloon. He informed me, in far from honeyed accents, that I was to be murdered that evening by order of the Mafia, to avenge the imprisonment of Manuel Lopez. Does that name convey anything to you, Tinker, my boy?"
Blake arched his eyebrows into interrogation.
"Well, I seem to have heard it before, Governor. Oh, wasn't he the Italian merchant that,
He paused uncertainly.
"It was 4 years ago," continued Sexton Blake. "I was instrumental in putting the villain behind prison bars for a richly deserved stretch of penal servitude. He swore to get even with me. And this is the result. The Mafia, as you know, is one of the most remorseless and relentless secret societies on earth. Lopez, I knew, was a member, and after his release, he probably awaited a favorable opportunity to get me."
Tinker started.
But I say, Governor, how could this secret society know you were in Rosario?
Why didn't they get you in London?
What's absurd? Nobody knew we were leaving Baker Street today. Oh, certainly no Italian could...
He broke off as a sudden light dawned on him.
Oh, I just remembered, Governor. There was that organ grinder Mrs. Bardell complained about. Perhaps he was a spy in the society.
Precisely. Sexton Blake rammed the wad of tobacco into his stained and blackened pipe. They've evidently been watching my movements. It is a comparatively simple thing to send a telegram to Rosario. Don't forget that the members of the Mafia are distributed all over the globe, and each one is pledged to avenge an injury to the society.
But, by Jove, Blake, said Briscoe, that's a pretty serious business for you, isn't it? You might be knifed before you can say,
He hesitated. Knife, replied Blake laconically, while his keen grey eyes twinkled. Don't worry about that. Threatened men live long. Negretti is just an agent of the Mafia. It was lucky for me that I managed to unloose my hands while the villain was at the cash desk, or assuredly I should have been murdered. The scoundrel meant business, and evidently intended to carry out the Mafia's death sentence. He told me as much, believing that I was entirely at his mercy. Then you arrived, my friends. Blake took a sip of his wine and patted Tinker affectionately on the shoulder.
Oh, Governor, I was glad to hear your voice. It's one of the toughest scraps you have ever taken a hand in.
Briscoe yawned slightly.
I hope you don't mind, Mr. Blake. I've had a pretty strenuous day, and if we're flying home tomorrow, I think I'll turn in. You're not expecting any night visits from your engaging Mafia friend?
He asked, and gazed ruminatively at his knuckles. Blake laughed. No, I don't think so. The amiable Negretti is in the custody of the police at the local calaboose. The gendarme rang me up a little while ago, and I shall charge him in the morning. Briscoe nodded good night, and passed through the swing doors of the hotel. As he did so, Tinker leant across to Blake.
I didn't have a chance to tell you before, Governor, but that American fella, Bruce...
He paused impressively.
He's in league with his spoofing majesty, Mr. Mike Malone.
Briefly, Tinker related what had transpired in the American's room, and how he had noticed the letter on the bureau. Blake pursed his lips thoughtfully, and blew a thin blue spiral of tobacco smoke.
That's extraordinarily interesting. I wonder whether...
He broke off abruptly. Oh, you'd better clear off to bed, Tinker, my lad, he said suddenly. That shoulder of yours will be all the better for a good long rest. You've done very well. Very well indeed. Tinker flushed with pleasure. It was not often that Sexton Blake condescended to praise him, and the youngster felt supremely content with his night's work. He rose to his feet.
Good night, Governor. Blowed if I can see any daylight in this business. The whole thing seems crazy to me. What with spoof kings, lords who lose their memories, and Italian assassins, to say nothing of old Llewellyn's missing microbes.
He shook his head regretfully as Sexton Blake, oblivious of his departure, curled his long, lean body into a more comfortable attitude, and gazed with brooding eyes across the deserted terrace. For nearly an hour he sat in silence. Far below came the sullen roar of the surf pounding the rocky foundations of the island. A warm breeze rustled the green fronds of the palm trees on the terrace, and in the wonderful velvet sky
The moon shone mistily white, like a dew-drenched petal. Blake stretched himself and fingered his bandaged head rather gingerly, then, knocking out the ashes of his pipe, entered the hotel, now in darkness. The detective's room was on the first floor, and in a few minutes he had changed into his pajamas and was soon between the sheets. Not a sound disturbed the silence of the night, save the dull boom of the sea 500 feet below, and the occasional shrill call of a seagull. Blake's head dropped wearily on the pillow, and almost immediately he sank into a dreamless slumber. An hour later, he awoke with a start, conscious of a vague scratching at his door. Immediately, his hand crept towards his pillow, and as his fingers clutched at the comforting butt of his automatic, he leapt out of bed and listened intently. Silence. Then a faint rattling of someone or something trying the bedroom door. Blake had his hand on the electric light switch, ready to snap the room into light as he stood there, keyed and tense. Motionless as a statue, he waited for the midnight intruder, and he smiled grimly as he heard the sudden, swift intake of breath from behind the locked door. Was it another member of the Mafia? Or, whoever it was that was trying to break in, had evidently thought better of it. For a moment later, the slight rustling sound ceased, and Blake heard soft footsteps padding on the thick pile carpet of the hotel corridor. Swiftly he dashed to the door and cautiously opened it. A solitary figure in pajamas was disappearing round the corner of the passage. The broad shoulders and erect bearing were familiar, and Blake started as he caught a fleeting glimpse of a strangely death-like face, almost a skull, the resemblance heightened by a pair of horn-rimmed spectacles. It was that of Booster Bruce, publicity man. Very thoughtfully, Blake closed the door. What had the American been up to? Why was he prowling round the hotel like a thief in the night, with that strange, uncanny expression on his face?
File 13.
The next morning, Sexton Blake and Tinker were down early. Captain Briscoe had already breakfasted and had gone over to his improvised landing ground to see his beloved Buff. Over their honey, rolls, and coffee, Blake told Tinker of Bruce's nocturnal prowl.
"Bless if I heard a thing, Governor," said the youngster, with a look of amazement. "I slept like a log. What do you think his giddy game is?"
Blake shook his head and frowned moodily. "I don't know, Tinker, but I believe we shall find out everything before the day is out." He pressed a warning finger to his lips as the dining room door opened suddenly, and the broad-shouldered figure of the American entered, with a cheerful smile on his countenance.
"Morning, Mr. Blake. Good morning, Mr. Tinker. And how do the balmy breezes of Rosario go down?"
"Quite nicely, thanks," said Blake noncommittally. "I didn't sleep very well last night, however," he added, and watched the American's face keenly. If he had expected Bruce to betray anything, he was disappointed, for the American clucked his tongue sympathetically.
"Oh, well now, that's pretty bad.
All myself, I could sleep the whole darn clock round in Rosario. I told you I'm going to Billet as the island where time stood still. Lord Lavendale and Mr. Gunn were tickled to death with the place. They'd have stayed another month if it could have been managed. Yeah, tell me, Mr. Bruce, how long have you been Rosario's publicity agent?
Broke in Blake suavely.
Why, about 2 months, I guess. You'll sure see some humdinging publicity ideas when you get home. Sable, I'm plastering the whole of London with Rosario posters. Lord Lavendale's disappearance and reappearance will set Fleet Street buzzing around to rediscover Rosario. I hear you were in a bit of a scrap last night, he added. More publicity. Do you mind if I hit the cables with a story? It'd look well in print. Sexton Blake captures crook. Romance in Rosario Island Paradise.
Blake laughed.
You mustn't let your fertile imagination lead you too far astray, Mr. Bruce. You'll excuse me now, won't you? I have some business letters to write.
He shot a meaning glance at Tinker, who turned to the American.
I wonder if you'd care to show me the sights of Rosario, Mr. Bruce?
He asked eagerly.
I'm quite new to the place, and I hear there's a marvellous medieval castle on the hill somewhere.
Why, sure, boy,
Booster Bruce said as he left the dining room with them.
After I've had my morning iron water, care to join me? It's imbued, as Dickens once said, with the flavor of warm flatirons. But it surely keeps you fit.
Tinker laughed. Sexton Blake strolled out of earshot and re-entered the hotel, while Tinker and the American sauntered over to the pump room to taste the somewhat overrated charms of Rosarian iron water. The detective watched them as they passed through the crowded terrace, and then, with a grim little smile playing round his finely chiseled lips, he strode purposefully down the corridor of the second floor. There was no one about at that hour, and Blake nodded with some satisfaction as he halted outside the American's bedroom door. Very gently, he inserted a slender wire instrument into the lock, and after a few minutes of experimental joggling, the catch flew back. His keen grey eyes scanned the room swiftly and scientifically, and a low cry escaped his lips as he noticed a wooden cupboard in the corner. It was locked, but that was no hindrance to the Baker Street sleuth. A little gentle teasing with the end of his flexible wire skeleton key soon opened the frail brass barrier. Inside the cupboard was a heap of carefully creased suits. Blake tossed them aside, and then whistled softly, for beneath the clothes reposed a wooden box, about a foot square, with handles of brass. Sexton Blake smiled significantly. The strange, tangled skein was now at last unraveled, and the mystery of Professor Llewellyn's stolen germs was now solved. Blake replaced the clothes over the brass-bound box and relocked the cupboard door. It was with a very thoughtful mien that he re-entered the hotel lounge and crossed over to the bookcase. He lit his pipe and took out a leather-bound volume, and for the space of half an hour read its closely printed pages with eager interest. It was nearly lunchtime when Tinker and Bruce returned. Sexton Blake rose to his feet as they entered the lounge and stepped over purposefully to the American.
Mr. Bruce, he said swiftly, and there was a steely glint in his grey eyes. What do you know of Chronopurdia? The American flushed.
What do you mean, Mr. Blake?
Don't you think we'd better talk this matter over? Broke in Blake icily. I think it's about time that you explained your somewhat oblique methods of publicity. The American blinked at him nervously through his horn-rimmed spectacles, and then shrugged his shoulders.
You're some sleuth, Mr. Blake. I'm darned if I know how you got wise to this proposition. But I guess I'd better tell you everything before you judge too harshly. When you come upstairs...
Tinker looked at Blake in some surprise as they followed in the American's wake. Blake's face was very grim and stern as he sat back in the luxurious armchair in Bruce's sitting room.
Well, Mr. Blake, you've called my bluff, said Bruce.
He was standing in a self-assured fashion with his back to the fireplace.
I guess I owe you an explanation.
What were you doing outside my bedroom in the middle of the night? Demanded Blake.
I'm darned if I know, Mr. Blake. I swear to you, I never left my...
He checked himself suddenly and lowered his voice.
To tell you the truth, Mr. Blake, I have a confession to make. I've discovered recently that I am a somnambulist, and perhaps I was walking in my sleep. It isn't the first time this has happened to me, and if you saw me in your room last night, believe me, I had no felonious intent.
Blake looked at him sternly.
Well, that may be, Mr. Bruce, he said, but you still have to explain why you're in possession of stolen property.
The American's mouth sagged open, and his eyes, oddly magnified by the horn-rimmed spectacles, goggled a little.
Say, what in thunder do you mean, Mr. Blake?
Sexton Blake rose to his feet, and he glanced squarely at the publicity man. No bluff, please. Let's have the whole story, he said. Bruce laughed.
Look here, Mr. Blake. I'll put all my cards on the table. I am Bruce. Booster Bruce, as they call me over in the States. I guess, according to your remarks about Chronopurdia, you've sized up my proposition. I'm a publicity man. I boost things. But I don't boost things in an ordinary fashion. Professor Mencken is a stepbrother of mine. I admit what I did was not strictly legal, but it's up to him and Professor Llewellyn to prosecute if they want to.
Tinker hunched his shoulders and glanced despairingly at his governor. He hadn't the vaguest notion what Chronopurdia meant. Blake smiled.
Ah, that clears up many things, Bruce, he said suavely. Your methods are irregular, but I must confess they have a certain amount of originality and success.
Success? Repeated the American.
Why, every darned newspaper in Europe is talking about Rosario. I guess I've an apology to make to you, Mr. Blake. You see, you have an international reputation. I wanted to focus the public eye on Rosario. That's why I prevailed upon my partner, Mr. Michael Malone, to come and see you. Sexton Blake is always a name to conjure with. And I tried to get you linked up with that spoof monarch stunt, but it wouldn't work. Still,
You're out here, and that's all I wanted. Now, to revert to Chronopurdia. He glanced across at Tinker with an amused smile. You see, my stepbrother, Professor Mencken, has been conducting researches in various obscure germs. Chronopurdia comes from the Latin. It means loss of time. You will remember, Mr. Blake, the case recently reported in the newspapers of a workman who lost all sense of time. Blake nodded. I see you study newspapers pretty closely, he said. Well, Professor Mencken has discovered that very rare germ, the Chronopurdia bacillus. If a man is infected with the germ, he loses his time sense. That's the reason of Lord Lavendale and Mr. Tom Gunn's very protracted, but very enjoyable stay. Blake nodded. A very pretty scheme, Mr. Bruce. You infected the mineral spring here with the germs. The American nodded. As a matter of fact, Mr. Blake, I did. I want Rosario to be known as the island where time stands still. I guess my methods sound a bit mad to you, but oh, darn me, if a man is on holiday, he don't need to be worried about time. Professor Mencken told me about his joint discovery with Professor Llewellyn. I called round to see that peppery old Welshman just before Mencken's departure for America. But you know what an absent-minded old ass he is? Blake nodded. If you think I'm committing a felony, Mr. Blake, you're mistaken, added Booster Bruce. My stepbrother gave me a letter to Llewellyn asking him to let me take charge of the Chronopurdia germs. But as the old bird was keen on a new and particularly virulent set of flu bacilli at the time, he probably forgot. Anyway, he let me have the box, and you can verify that by cable if you like. Sexton Blake nodded. That's an extraordinary story, Bruce, he said crisply. Time will show whether you're speaking the truth or not. You deliberately infected the drinking water of Rosario in order to advance your publicity schemes. Well, you're a little devious in your methods, even though you are successful in publicity. It's not my business to prosecute. I can leave that to other people. Booster Bruce laughed. Gee, Mr. Blake, it's the finest stunt I've ever put across. There's absolutely no harm in the Chronopurdia germ. Its effect on the system is only temporary. Sexton Blake laughed shortly. Publicity pays, Mr. Bruce. And I hope publicity experts will do so. It's been an interesting little problem, but, say, Mr. Blake, just name your fee for loss of time and your researches, said the American. I've got my checkbook here, and the whole funds of the Rosarian government are back of me. Sexton Blake smiled. Please make it out for 1,000 guineas, he said. Booster Bruce sat down at his writing desk and signed a check with a flourish. Cheap at the price, Mr. Blake. The whole world is talking about Rosario. It's my job to boost. I guess I've succeeded. Tinker looked across at the American with wide eyes. He was a new kind of fish. Even to the lad who had, in the course of his adventurous life, met an extraordinarily miscellaneous collection of characters. You type the kite, Bruce, he said. You surely do. Say, was it you who fought with that phantom hound stunt in the tube?
The American stuck a cigar aggressively in the left-hand corner of his mouth.
"Sure," he said. "But that was only a sideline of mine. And now, what about a little lunch?"